Welcome to the Hospital Finance Podcast, your go-to source for information and insights that can help you protect and enhance revenue at your hospital. And now, the host of the Hospital Finance Podcast, Michael Passanante.
Hi, this is Mike Passanante, and welcome back to the Hospital Finance Podcast. We're glad you could be with us. Today, we are joined by a few people. We have Christine Gordon, who is a manager of reimbursement at Virtual Hospital here in the wonderful Garden State of New Jersey. We also have Kate Gillespie, who is the Associate Vice President of the Orthopedic and Spine Service Line, also at Virtua. And today we're also joined by Maria Miranda, who is the Director of Emerging Payment Models at Bessler Consulting. Welcome, everyone.
Hi, thank you.
It's great to have you with us. And we literally just left your presentation at the New Jersey HFMA annual meeting. And the reason we wanted to have you on the podcast today is because you had a great topic where you talked about your experience in Medicare's BPCI, and you know shared some of your best practices, shared some of the things that you've gone through, and not only how you're going through it now, but how you're going to take those learnings into future as bundled payments are really where Medicare and maybe private payers will soon be going. So. With that, we'll just kind of jump right in. So in your presentation, you outlined some key strategies to start building a bundled payment program. Can you share with us what those strategies were?
I think that on that first slide, we really said the two key elements was first having your leadership support you. If they don't support you, you're not going to get anywhere off the ground. The second, I think, is really about your surgeons. We felt the surgeons were really the key to delivery of care. So we really needed them at the table. If we're going to make any changes or any additions, they need to be at the table and be supportive of it as well. So if you have those two, you have a good foundation.
And, you know, you went through some lessons at the end of the presentation. I'm sure you hit several as you went through. Could you share with the audience some of the lessons that you learned as you went through the program?
Some of the lessons that I think that we've learned is education. That's one of it. I mean, we've listened to every phone call, webinar, podcast, you know, we can get our hands on to make sure that we're up to date on everything that we need to do to make the program successful. Engage with the physicians and the leadership buy-in is totally part of it. And working with the post-acute folks. I mean, that's the biggest piece of the pie in regards to cost savings and working with those folks to manage that piece of the pie with the post-acute disposition, I think, is important.
Now, let me ask you about that, because some of the, I guess, other providers we've talked to or other presentations we've been in, and they look at that whole pie and they're thinking inpatient. Right? How does that differ for you, or is there just a different perspective, or is it truly just when you look at your own cost structure? Do you think it's unique to you, or do you think that's projectable?
I mean, we actually have a consultant that works with us in regards to our data mining, and even before we started this, I mean, the post-acute part of it is the biggest piece of the pie in regards to cost. You're looking at, you know, pre-admission testing to 30 days out. When you look at the total cost of what it costs for a person to have, you know, hip replacement or knee replacement, The post-acute is the biggest piece of that cost. So it surprises me that other folks aren't managing that or know that, because that's the biggest piece of the cost for
and
it.
I agree with you. And the issue around that is that's the period of time in the episode that you sometimes don't have the control. So you're going into some, you have control of the hospital per se, but you don't have control when they leave that hospital. So for jumping in, it is a risky model, because you now have to get your arms around the post-acute. One, making sure they're going to the appropriate site. But two, when they're going to that site, you have to have the buy-in from those facilities.
Exactly. Now, I had a question for you. So you mentioned that with your BPCI model, your episode period is only 30 days. Once you move into CJR in the next couple of years, that goes out to 90 days. Does that change how you collaborate with those post-acute care providers?
I think it does, but if we've built the foundation now, the fact that moving out 90 days will not be as dramatic a change for us. Because if we can really network and collaborate with our post-acute, we then would then at that point negotiate or really collaborate with our primary care physicians and seeing, making sure that in the community we have the resources to manage that patient.
Right.
So I think I think what we've built today will help support the 90 days.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest risks when you go from 30 to 90 days too is the whole readmissions piece of it, because now you're going
out. We're seeing readmissions now in 30 days, so we take a really close look at that. And some of them, with the CMS being able to see the claims data, we can see readmissions that could have been avoidable. So bringing them to the, not even to the surgeons, because sometimes the surgeon doesn't even realize they're being readmitted, is if they went to a post-acute, or if home care was in there and initiated the readmission, and the ED docs, how can we align them to understand that not every patient that comes to the ED has to be admitted? And we don't want to change their metrics and how they practice medicine, but more of an alert and awareness that there are other team members following that patient, and we need to make sure that we collaborate with them.
Now, you mentioned as part of your program, when you kind of scoped it out, you thought about gain sharing, and you really brought the surgeons in primarily, really as the actor with you in the gain sharing. And I thought during the question and answer period, there was kind of an interesting thing that you said, because you said the side effect of that was it got the surgeons in the room and really got them thinking about this program, how they conducted their procedures, and really what costs meant to them. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
It was interesting that when we brought them together, not only talking about savings on their implants or looking at their protocols, that as they started talking with each other and we talked about certain things that we could standardize, some surgeons would say, oh, I do that. Other surgeons says, well, why are you doing that? That's not current practice. So not that it was competitive, but I think it brought that conversation out, and then we were able to move certain surgeons to more current practices, mm-hmm. which I don't think we could ever have done as a virtual employee or an AVP as an orthopedist going to a surgeon saying, we want you to change your mm-hmm. practice. It came better from their own peers.
Sure.
And we
know that physicians love data, right? And they are competitive by nature. Do you share quality data with them as well as part of this?
We're very transparent. At first, we would just show them certain individual scores. Now we actually show them everyone else's scores as well. So it was a hard transition for virtual to do that, and they started doing it in certain other departments, such as colorectal and other kind of surgeries. But now we share the data, good or bad, and they still question it. And they still question it. They'll still question it. But we now have the data behind it, saying your readmission rate was such, and here's all your patients that were readmitted and why they were readmitted and where they came from, whether it be home or skilled nurse facility. So we have the backing where we didn't have that before. So it's been really great.
And that makes a difference, because, you know, a lot of them are going to think, well, my patients are a lot sicker than everybody else's patients.
We hear that too. We hear that.
But when you have the data right there in front of you, and then they can also compete against themselves and get better as they go.
Yeah.
So it's great.
Beautiful thing.
And I think you touched on a little bit around the costs of the devices themselves. Can you expand a little bit about how, or if you've kind of tackled that beast yet, as far as making selections around what implants the surgeons could use or should use, or how do you mandate that or massage that with them?
I don't know the exact part of, you know, mandating, but the supply chain, you know, folks are definitely part of our team, and we have worked with them closely on the cost of the implants and all the supplies, and, you know, standardizing and getting the physicians in the room to talk about, you know, I use this implant from this supplier and this one uses this, and what's our quality for this, and measuring it. Already we've seen a reduction, at least a 15% reduction in our supply costs just by our initial, you know, getting them all together to manage it. As far as them specifically, have they
what we did was, again, transparent. So if a surgeon, five surgeons are doing the same surgery, mm-hmm. there's preference cards. So we show them the preference cards, because we'll show them what's their cost per that surgery. And they're like, well, it's because I have, the patient needed this, this, and this. So what we did was we showed them each surgeon, for this surgery, these are all the elements that you use. And it gave us an opportunity because some of the surgeons said, well, I never use that. I said, well, it's on your preference card that you do. So this is great. So it actually was a really great eye-opener for the surgeon, for us to say, look, this is what we see that you're using. If you're not using that and something's amiss, we need to correct it. At that point, that we helped really reduce the amount of equipment needed in surgery. The other part of that is that we were able to use the information to go back to our vendors and say, these are the surgeons that use your equipment. This is a surgeon here that's agreed that if you don't come down to this price, we may not use your implant. So we were able to get the surgeons to feel comfortable with us and trust us enough to say, we're now going to the vendors and negotiate better
and
prices.
And they're definitely feeling the pressure because they know this is coming.
Wow. Yes.
And this is here.
And in your presentation, just to kind of flip gears a little bit, you mentioned that you have some really pretty dramatically low inpatient stay days as it is. Do you anticipate trying to move more patients to sort of an outpatient or home the same day kind of a situation to avoid the inpatient risks? I mean, is it more just a screening kind of a thing to try to figure that out ahead of time?
With Medicare, they're not there yet. I've saw a couple articles out that Medicare is looking at it, but right today, Medicare does not recognize same-day surgery. It's only a commercial. So we're now looking at the same-day surgery for the commercial patients, and then really looking at the criteria for those. So we'll keep them in our joint replacement in a hospital setting, but they'll stay same day. And then that way, in preparation for the move, which we anticipate in probably the next 3 or 4 years, then we know the selected criteria. Because the one thing you don't want to do is have a patient have their joint done in an ambulatory center, and then they're being admitted, which is
right.
Not inequality. So we really want to take a look at making sure we pick the right patients. It's not going to be for everyone, because we have some patients that have really high comorbidities that should not be done in an ambulatory. But I would say it's probably about, they're saying 50%. I'm not sure about that, but I would say it's probably going to be 30 to 40% of our patients at some point in time can get it done in an ambulatory center. But Medicare, they're not quite there yet.
Yeah.
You mentioned commercial, so I thought I'd jump there. Do you have any contracts? Do you contemplate having any contracts that mimic the CJR type, the episodic payment?
We are working on it. Our managed care department is working on it with several different payers and even companies in the area to do a bundled payment program.
Does it feel like you're getting that feedback from the managed care payers at this point that they want that kind of situation?
Absolutely. Yeah. They absolutely do. They're in the same boat. I mean, they mimic Medicare. Mm-hmm. You guys know that so much, you know, follow Medicare rules and that kind of thing for rates and regulations. So they're definitely moving in that direction. A little slower because they're, you know, they have that black hole data box.
Right. And that's the thing. Like, you'd have to get the data from them.
Yes.
So this is... this is more of a crystal ball type of question, but we talked a little bit about it right before we started the podcast. So you're in BPCI, you know, you've got a little bit of runway left for that. CJR is running a couple of years beyond BPCI, right? So, you know, there's maybe this anticipation that you'll end up in that CJR program at some point. But, you know, one of the things that Medicare sort of laid out was that these are pilot programs, but if they go well, you know, we kind of reserve the right to just make it for everyone. Does it feel like that might be coming?
Oh, absolutely. About a year ago, when we first got into the program, CMS was doing a seminar up in New Jersey Hospital Association, and they invited us to come and talk about our Model 2. So they had Model 2, Model 3, BPCI. And they also did a presentation on all the pilot programs they have. And they specifically mentioned that they are definitely, there are some that they thought would go away, but they felt that the Model 2 and the BPCI was definitely going to stay, and that it would morph into something else, which now we know is probably, at least for the joints would be the CCRJR, definitely is something that they're going for. And I mean, we're anticipating, again, spine, cardiology is coming.
Yeah.
So we're creating that same model and the mentality of let's care for the episode of care, do it now, because that way we'll be ready. We don't want to be put in a position where we're caught and saying, we have to scramble. And
yeah.
So I think that's why really lessons learned about the joint program.
Well, and the last question that I'd like to just get your thoughts on, and I think it's a good one to leave with, because you've got hospitals in different states of flux with this, right? Some are ahead of the curve, maybe they're in BPCI. Others are having CJR forced upon them. Others haven't had any program forced upon them yet, or maybe aren't in BPCI. So they're in lots of different places. And I think one of the first points you brought up in your presentation was how to convene the team. How do you get started? And I think that's a good point of best practice. Could you just talk a little bit about your experience with that?
I mean, I think that's been a key part of our success. I mean, Kate is, you know, the joint replacement person, but, you know, her and I co-chairing the committee, you know, from a finance and Medicare perspective, from my point of view and her clinical, we were able to put together a team that really works together. Everybody is on the team, you know, medical records, case management, the PT folks, and that's a key, getting the physicians aligned, everybody together. And we were meeting, you know, once a month. It was a little much, but once a month we all came together and all talked about how this would work internally for Virtua to make the program successful. And I think that's key. I would tell everybody, you know, get your teams together and listen. I mean, we joke about all the webinars we listen to. I mean, I was on the phone 24 hours a day, it seemed like, listening to bundled payment stuff. But, you know, like Kate said in there, even if you picked up one thing from every two-hour call, it was worth it. Like, we have binders full of notes and stuff. But if you pick up one piece of information, it's so worth it in regards to how successful your program can be. So working together with all the different departments really is key as far as somebody that hasn't started yet, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Kate, Christine, Maria, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much. And please enjoy the rest of the conference and good luck with the rest of your program.
Thank you.
If you have a topic that you'd like us to discuss on the Hospital Finance Podcast, or if you'd like to be a guest, drop us a line at update@bessler.com.
This concludes today's episode of the Hospital Finance Podcast. For show notes and additional resources to help you protect and enhance revenue at your hospital, visit Bessler.com/podcasts. The Hospital Finance Podcast is a production of Bessler Consulting.